What's up, knife freaks, sharpness geeks, and purveyors of stabbing goodness? Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. My name is Jonathan McNeese. This is Mr. Chase Boatwright.
Hola.
All right. So here we are again, trying to battle through the heat of summer and making it.
Yeah. I didn't even tell you this off air, but my air conditioning in my house went out this week.
Oh, no fun.
Yeah, it was out for, only day and a half. Luckily, I got a buddy of mine who's a HVAC technician person.
Yeah.
And he figured it out pretty quick. He was over here for maybe an hour and already had it fixed.
Well, that's so good. But, yeah, that's tough this time of year. I mean, it could be. Luckily, I guess it was a little bit cooler here this past week than it's been being. So,
yeah. Still wasn't necessarily comfortable in the house at 85 degrees or whatever it was, and certainly didn't sleep good that night. And
yeah,
that's just been one thing after another.
that's part of the welcome to home ownership. It's always something. So,
2 weeks ago, our washing machine decided to stop working.
Well, ours did this week. So thanks for passing that along to me.
Hope your AC's not next.
No kid, don't even jinx me. Maybe we just had AC put in out here at the shop, so maybe that was our AC thing and we're good.
I don't wish that on anybody.
That's tough. If it went out completely in the house, we'd be out here sleeping in the shop until we could get it fixed, which we are too. Luckily in our house, we've got part of it is an addition, so we actually have two units. One unit, so technically, unless something really bad happens, we should be able to segment off and have somewhere cool in there at least. But anyway,
that's neat.
Our washing machine, we killed it. I think pretty much everybody on here knows that we've got multiple dogs, and one of them we had to wash a dog bed or whatever, something kind of bulky the other day. And somehow it literally killed the washing machine. Like a cord got yanked loose. It pulled some kind of plug thing from the inside loose. I don't even know. It killed it, killed it. To the point I was like, oh, no, that's by the time we paid to have it repaired, it probably would have cost what a new one would anyway. So
about where we were with this one. We'd had it since 2017, and it was some sort of electrical component, like the motherboard basically decided it just didn't want to work and it wasn't sensing stuff right. So we got a relatively older one that's kind of a dumb one that just has a switch.
Yeah.
And doesn't have this control panel thing that, those things that like to break.
Yep.
So failure points, as we like to call them. But so anyway.
Isn't it crazy? So that actually, when you said that, it sparked a thought in my mind that, with everything just about now that we deal with, we all know that it's not made like it used to. Think about appliances. I see memes and stuff about it too, where people are talking about, wanting a fridge like their parents had or whatever, that would last forever. And that's the thing, you remember, when I was growing up, it was not common at all to replace appliances. Just didn't wear out. They lasted forever. And if they did tear up, they were typically easier to work on. And a lot of times you could repair them yourself if you're kind of handy, So the world has gone that direction a whole lot of, I think some of that is planned obsolescence where they know that they're going to tear up quicker and they basically build them for that purpose. And then some of it's just making stuff as cheap and as easy as you can make it and not really worrying about how long it lasts, as long as it can last long enough. But the thought that gave me was, that carries over into knives some too. Amy and I have talked a good bit, especially recently, about, how we're building stuff that we intend to be legacy items that we plan on people passing down, to their kids and grandkids and stuff and I'll say this, there's a lot of really cool, all the knives that are out there now that are, and I say knives by the technical sense of the term they are, but all these knives out there now that take replaceable razor blades, there's a bunch of cool ones out there. But like, and there's definitely a place for using a razor blade, a razor knife versus using your pocket knife, right? There's yeah. for sure. You know, I used to, when I did construction, like we use a razor knife, like that's like the stuff we use a razor knife for, you, a pocket knife would not have been ideal for the job at all.
You know,
yeah. Like this yeah, stuff like, that's not, you know, we cut ceiling tile, like you needed a razor blade. So they have their place for sure. But when I see people carrying them, like as their like everyday carry pocket knife, it bugs me because it's dude, carry something that's like permanent and like, or at least more permanent. I mean, everything wears out, but like, you know what I mean? Like, let's get back away from this whole disposable, you know, ideology where we just make stuff and discard it and it doesn't mean anything to us. Like that's, I mean,
yeah, the paper plate mentality.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, I don't know. It's just kind of,
yeah, that definitely plays a factor into like what we're trying to do in a world of, you know, disposable items or, you know, limited life items, you know, things that are intended to wear out. Like I just got this new computer because basically my old computer wouldn't support the new stuff. I was like Fusion and stuff that I was trying to put on it.
Right.
It was going to be basically timed out by that point. So it's going to be yep. kind of useless in that regard.
And yep.
my iPhone is an iPhone 8 and I can't edit movies on there with iMovie because it doesn't allow for that. It doesn't update far yeah. enough. So
yeah.
yeah, like it's,
yeah,
it's one of those things that just sucks about modern society.
Yeah. It's there's a lot of benefits to technology, but there's also downsides to it too. But it's, but yeah, with knives, like to think of having something that's you know, an item that you can be proud of, that you can, you know, that you can pass down to your kids and grandkids, and not only that, but that doesn't feel so generic, I guess, and kind of just, you know, not special. Like you have no idea where it was made. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we use is like disposable. We don't think about it. We don't care. We don't whatever, like where it was made, who made it, whatever, any of the process behind it. But I don't know. I just feel like with knives are such a innate tool for us, for humans, that I feel like we have a deeper connection to them than we do a lot of tools, with it being one of the oldest tools known to man. So yeah. I just kind of feel like we have a like special connection to it, and that deserves us to, you know, hold it in a little bit of reverence and want to have something that's, you know, that's special, that means something, that we care about the story behind it and who made it and that kind of stuff. Like, maybe I'm just being a little overly romantic about it, but I think that especially in this day and age, as everything heads the other direction more and more, that's an important aspect to not lose.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I definitely understand where you're coming from. It doesn't sound too romantic to me, but I mean, I think that's kind of the audience we also have, you know, that's yeah. the knife freak mentality. I think we all kind yeah. of have that, but I mean, in general, I mean, I always say it's the second oldest tool in the world, because I assume somebody hit a rock with another rock, that being
yeah.
you know, a hammer.
Yeah. Yeah. An impact device of some kind, a hammer, a club, something yeah. like that was probably.
And then that beget the first knife, you know, of flint or obsidian or, you know, whatever. Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of those, I guess, primal sort of feelings, I guess, for me that I get from knives as well.
Yep. Yep. For me too. I think that it's, for a lot of us, at least, I have no idea what the explanation is why some people could care less about knives and some people don't, but that's, you know, I feel like we're all at least somewhat connected to it, you know, yeah. primally, like you said.
I mean, if you look around, just, you know, take a scan around the room, everything in our life is sort of based on our ability to separate two things and also put two things together.
Yep.
Like, everything in the world is basically revolved around that, around cutting and attaching.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, so it's, I don't know, I guess it's one of those, like, base instinct sort of things for me.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, it's something to think about.
Yeah, yeah. Just one of those, I guess, random things. How was your week in the shop?
It was pretty good. Actually, it was really good. So, you know, I keep talking about us trying to get on schedule and stay on schedule. And this week, we, We got a little bit technically, got a little off schedule by the end of the week, but nothing that we couldn't. I've actually worked some this weekend to help catch us up. But we've also had, we had one of our guys out 2 days just on a, you know, vacation days or whatever. And so that, that was the main reason. That and I spent some time on our blade grinding was one of the places where we got a little bit, like I said, behind, technically behind, but not enough to actually, that we can't make it up. But it was because I took some time out from grinding Dixon blades to try to work on prototyping something else. And so that that's, I thought we were ahead enough that I could sneak it in, but it turned out that it slowed us down a little bit. But anyway, but all in all, good. We hit our goal number for the week again, which is fantastic. And basically what we're trying to accomplish right now is just be consistent hitting our goal. And if we can do that, you know, for a few weeks, then we can start to push. And as we start to push to see how much more we can do, that'll make our weak points show up, our bottlenecks, so that we know what we need to do, whether it's add employees, add machines, whatever. So
yeah,
anyway,
and that's one of the hard parts about trying to like keep up with production and stuff like that is also trying to find time to do new things and you know, hammer out those new processes and stuff. It's
especially if you're running really lean like we are right now, like we're trying to basically, like we're right on the verge of being understaffed. If we're not, like I said, these few weeks here of seeing if we can stay on schedule and hit our goal for, you know, a few weeks in a row. If we can do that, then that'll tell me that we have enough staff, but it's like, it's close enough. It's like where if somebody takes a day off, it potentially hurts us. Take a couple of days off, it's for sure going to slow us down. So, you know, yeah. And the same thing with the machines, which we've already, I don't know if I've already said it on here, but I've got another machine coming that should be here. I think it'll be here next month. So
nice.
We've already another pulled the trigger on that. Yeah. No, just like the other new ones that we got, another BF. Actually, it's got a couple of features on it that those didn't have just because I was able to get a deal on it. But, So that's pretty cool. And speaking of that, that sparked something else we'll talk about in a minute, but just put a pin in that for a second. If I didn't say it, I'll probably forget it though. So if I didn't at least bring it up. So, so it's been good. And we're really, I feel like starting to kind of, you know, reach a really good point where I'm not just battling every day to try to figure out what's going wrong and why we're not being able to keep everything flowing the way I want it to. So
yeah, that's good.
How was your week?
It was pretty good. Had some grinder time this week, and some of it was good and some of it was bad. It's always rough getting, like, after, if I go a couple weeks without grinding blades, kind of getting the feel back into it and stuff, because for those that, you know, don't know, if you maybe just tuning in, I freehand grind all my blades, and so it's always kind of a, you know, is this going to be a good grinding day sort of thing? And, you know, kind of feeling out the process. And had some good ones, had a couple bad ones that I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to save, but, you know, it is what it is, I guess.
I'll
do everything I can to save them. And if I can't, it's better just to start a new blade and go from there.
Yep. Move along. That's the thing. I actually had you made me think when you said about the freehand grinding, we had a guy that cuts our grass. He's a young guy. He just actually started cutting our grass before he was even out of high school. He just graduated this past spring. And so he's got his lawn care business. He's got a couple of people that he's hired to help him. And nice. Super cool. Yeah. I mean, I love, you know, encouraging and supporting younger, anybody that's working on trying to build up a business, but especially somebody young like that. But anyway, he's been really, excited about what we do. Like he's just really like he constantly reposts our stuff on Facebook, you know, for kind of local people or whatever. And anyway, he came in last week and I was talking to him and he said he'd actually started trying to make knives. And so he was showing me a picture of what he'd been doing or whatever. And he said something about he needed to get a jig so he could clean his grinds up. And I was like, well, you can, and there's not technically anything wrong with it by any means, but if you have any desire to learn to freehand grind, then if you get a jig, then unless you're very disciplined, then you're probably never going to learn to freehand grind, because it's just, you know, you kind of choose one or the other, you know?
Yeah. Once you kind of go down that path, like, that's the biggest problem. I've tried a few jigs, but they don't grind like I grind freehand.
It locks it into a different. Yeah.
Yeah. That my body can do without having to think about it, which I would have to take and, you know, put the knife in the jig one way and then put it in the jig the other way and try to blend them together and, you know, do all sorts of weird stuff. And that's just not how I learned to do it. So it's unfamiliar and weird to me. So I don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, and there's nothing that says that anybody has to, you know, learn to freehand grind, but as I personally think it's cool. I feel like it's, you know, the kind of the, I don't know, like,
it's the craftsmanship, the skill side of things, I think.
Yeah. That, it's keeping it. Yeah.
In our mind.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It keeps it as kind of, it's a more purist form of doing it, basically. So, you know, with less, I mean, you could chase that rabbit hole, you know, and say that you shouldn't be grinding in the first place and just be using files, or, you know, I'm sure the smith side of the industry would say you're supposed to be forging it, even though they grind too. So it's, I don't know. But for me, from a grinding standpoint, yeah, I always liked the thought of being able to just freehand grind. So, not that, and there really weren't, there probably were a couple, but there definitely wasn't as much variety or accessibility of grinding jigs out there at the time. Like now, several people sell them and stuff, but.
Oh yeah. And they've gone way down in price too. Like they used to be very expensive to get into. Like even when I started, you know, it was $400 or $500 or so. And then now the last one I got, I think I got for 120 or something like that. And it came from Australia. Mm. So it's, you know, I think I paid, you know, $30 for shipping or something like that from Australia, but still it, you know,
yeah,
a lot easier to jump into. I think they even have them on Amazon. Don't know how good they are, but you know, it's,
yeah,
everything like that is a lot easier to jump into these days. There's a lot of, you know, cheaper equipment accessible.
Yeah. And this, it being cheaper and it being, you know, I've never even ground with one, so I definitely can't speak to it, but I mean, I've seen other people that have not ground, you know, I've seen their grind, you know, their work, them showcase their work, and knowing that they like just started grinding knives, like, I don't think there's any argument that it's easier to grind a clean looking blade with a jig than it is freehanding it. So
you still have to be, you still have to know what you're doing, still have to mind your P's and Q's.
It's not guaranteed, but I think it's safe to say that it's easier, that it lowers the barrier to entry of being able to grind blades by having a jig.
Yeah.
So it just kind of
depends. It removes some of the variables, at least.
Right.
Of, you know, holding it and some of the twisting and, you know, some of the vectors at play are different when using a jig.
But yep.
Anyway. Yeah. So
I've just,
sorry, go ahead.
No, I've just always kind of been more of the, you know, stubborn for one thing, and like, again, kind of felt a little more like, I don't know, the purist side of it or whatever, where like, okay, I want to be able to just grab a piece of steel and step up to a wheel and go to town, you know. But
yeah,
again, I'm not knocking it. It's just,
I really do enjoy that idea as well, that I can just grab a piece of steel in basically any knife maker's shop. I don't have to have my jig or my work rest or anything else, and I can make a knife in somebody else's knife shop. I do like that idea, but I also, you know, I've been thinking more and more about the jig just because, like, to try to make things more efficient, consistent. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah. From the business side of things, it probably makes more sense to use a jig. Like if you're more worried about, you know, you're less worried about the like craftsman side and more worried about, you know, the business side, then you should probably, you know, do that. It gives you more consistency, you know, probably, I don't know, depending on, if you're new at it, for sure, faster. You know, I don't know if somebody that's been grinding for a bunch of years versus somebody grinding with, you know, freehand grinding versus somebody with a jig. I don't know that the jig would actually be faster than a master grinder, but for somebody that's new to it, for sure it's faster. It's, you can get to a good looking blade a whole lot quicker than you can trying to learn how to freehand it. Most people, I mean, different people have different, you know, some people just take the stuff quicker, have different talents. So it's, you know, that's all subjective, but anyway, anyway,
so that was my week. I was, you know, spent the week grinding, but, one of the things we meant to bring up last week, and something that is approaching quickly, it seems, a couple months away now, 2 months away, is Blade Show West. And you will be there. I will not be there. But what do you you got anything you want to speak to on that?
Just that it's not as far as like what we're bringing and that kind of stuff yet, because honestly, we're just – like pretty soon, probably within the next couple of weeks, we're going to have to start kind of thinking about that and getting it done. But so far, I kind of have a general vague idea of kind of the mix of stuff I want to take, but like nothing specific yet. So, but as far as the show in general, it's a really cool show. It's similar to the Texas show in a lot of ways. I don't think, at least last year, it wasn't quite as big as the Texas show. But all of those shows are growing every year, so we'll see what it's like this year. It's a pretty cool place. And like last year, I mean, there's some stuff to do around there. Last year, I think the day after the show, we ended up going and renting a truck and did some driving around and went to some places there around sightseeing and stuff. So doing the tourist thing. I mean, so it's a pretty
Utah's
cool
a
place.
Beautiful state. I would love to get out there just to go to the national parks and all that sort of stuff out there.
Like, yeah.
It's absolutely beautiful from pictures.
Yeah.
It's in Salt Lake City for those that don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Salt Lake City. Like we went out to the place called Antelope Island. It's not that far away. It's pretty cool. There's like bison out there just roaming around in this. Yeah. I guess it's technically like an island kind of deal or whatever, but it's not. You access it by road. Like you don't have to take a ferry or anything, but anyway, it's a pretty cool place. There's some, cool history there and got to see some herd of bison out there just hanging out. So that's pretty cool. But, anyway, that's a cool place. So it was, but the show itself, like I said, it was good. Similar to the Texas show in size and just kind of the feel of it. The people out there were all super nice. You know, you get people coming from all over, but like in Texas, you get a bigger percentage of people that are from that area, from Texas, Oklahoma, you know, that general area. And Utah, same thing. You get more local or local-ish people there. So it, you know, the vibe tends to kind of go with whatever the local vibe is. So everybody that was super nice, like very, very nice people. So enjoyed that a lot. Got to talk to a lot of really nice, really cool people. So, but yeah, if you're in a position where you could go to it, I would highly recommend doing it. It's a really fun, cool show. Blade Show does a great job. Alicia and them do a great job of putting it on as always. So, and it's just going to keep growing. So,
And that's pretty October fun. 10th and 11th. By the way, for anybody wondering, you can go to bladeshowwest.com or bladeshow.com and then find Blade Show West.
Yeah, Blade Show and I West. Believe tickets are on sale now, too.
Yes, they are. So,
and probably never too early to start mentioning our booth will be 226. So, like I said, it's not a huge, huge show, so it's a little easier to find us than it is at Atlanta, but it's definitely worth doing. If it's something you can do, by all means, it's worth doing. And since it's not as crazy as Atlanta, like you actually have a chance to potentially, there's basically less competition for the stuff that you're wanting to buy. So as a customer going, you know, it's, you can get a chance, you know, there's still a lot of the really big name people that are going to be there. and you get a chance to get stuff, or even to just talk to people that maybe, you know, just stay swamped the whole time at Atlanta that you might not ever get a chance to talk to, and they might be free and open or whatever at a smaller show like that. So
yeah, that was going to be my next point, was, you know, at a less crowded show like that, or a less big show, I guess, you can often have better conversations with the makers and, you know,
yeah,
for us, better conversations with the collectors and stuff, since things yeah. are so hectic as Atlanta.
Yeah, a little more intimate, I guess, would be the way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, there's less stuff, you know, it's just a smaller room, so, you know, the customer doesn't feel like they have to, you know, speed run the whole thing
yeah.
to try to see everything, so, because Atlanta will beat you down if you know, you
yeah.
try to do that all at once, all in one hit, so.
Yeah. All right, and so, if you're the kind of person that maybe, you know, would love to go to a show, but Atlanta's just a little overwhelming for you, like, you just don't, you know, not a lot of people don't like being in crowds and stuff, so this is yeah. it's definitely more laid back and you know, would be better for somebody that's maybe doesn't like big crowds and that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
come on out and see us.
Sweet. All right. Oh yeah, did you want to go back to the new Haas thing, or was that something you were wanting to wait for future?
No, yeah, we'll go ahead and touch on it. So
okay.
The thought that came into my mind about it was to do with the tariffs and stuff. Because you're seeing some stuff out there now where people are starting to get hit with price increases on different stuff, to include machines and stuff. That's what made me think about it. But I'm not going to say that, don't know what the future is going to hold, you know, but then Haas is obviously, it's an American company, it's an American made machine, but obviously not every single component of that machine is made in the U.S. I mean, that's just, you know, it's not the way it is. So, but surprisingly, I got the best deal on it that I've ever gotten on a Haas. So like, yeah, I mean, you know, I would have honestly kind of expected that it was going to be worse because of the tariff situation, but for whatever reason, I don't know. And I don't know if they're just absorbing it and, you know, I don't know what the deal is, but so that was great. And then we did get hit. We'll talk about this more down the road, but like, I just put in another order for a whole bunch of MagnaCut. I've got a pretty good stockpile that's from the old stuff before Aristeel bought it. This new order, when we get it in, which we're months away from using up the stock we've got now, but once we do and we switch this other, obviously it will be, and I'll talk about it some more, just so I want to be transparent about everything, you know, because that's, I think most everybody knows now that you know, you're not going to have a choice to buy any of the CPM steels basically that are not coming from Sweden. Like it all is going to come from there now. There. So unless you're going to go to a non CPM steel, then that's what you got to do. So,
yeah.
And the market, I don't think, is going to support moving much away from, you know, MagnaCut in particular. Like, you know, I mean, it's just, I think the majority of people are going to be like, that don't care that it was made in Sweden, and they'd still rather buy MagnaCut. And if you try to offer, you know, something that's not MagnaCut, you're going to just not have the sales. So, but I will say this, at least it's Sweden. Like, it's another, you know, it's a friendly country. It's an ally. It's not, you know, a communist enemy of the state. So that makes me feel a lot better. But I also learned the other day a little bit more about, just from watching some videos where other people were talking about it, a little bit more about the process, that technically what comes from Sweden from there is like basically a big block of steel. Like, they smelt it, like it's this big block of steel. It comes over in that form, and then Niagara actually rolls it out into sheets, and then obviously it comes to us in sheets, and we get cut up and all that. So, like, you know, yes, it's in the purest sense of the word, no, it's not, you know, 100% being made in the U.S., but to take it from a chunk of steel and to turn it into a sheet that we can work with, and for us to take that sheet and turn it into blanks, and then to take those blanks and turn them into working parts, Like, to me, that's
a long way. Yeah.
That's a long way from being, you know, a chunk of steel coming out of the shop in Sweden to all the things that are done to it in between there that are done in the U.S. So, you know, yeah. It kind of is what it is on that. But that's, I would prefer that every single piece of iron ore and everything else came from the United States and every, you know, 100% of the process was done here. But you also have to live in world reality, and it's just not possible. So at this current state and time. So anyway, but the bigger point that brought me to that was, and I honestly haven't paid a lot of attention to what other people are doing as far as their prices and stuff, especially the people that are importing stuff. But I need to recheck my math and make sure that I'm 100% right on this. But if I did the math right, I broke it down because when I put in this order for this next round of steel, it's definitely a price increase. And it's a significant increase. But when I broke it down, like average of what it's going to cost us extra per blade, per knife, if I did the math right, it came out to like between $2 and $3. So obviously I'm not doing a price increase because of a $2 or $3 increase in steel prices. You know, now that doesn't mean the other costs are not going to go up too or whatever, but you know, so I mean, it's possible that for some companies, enough things could add up to where they do have to do a price increase. But just, I could also see people, and I've seen customers at least claiming that they thought companies would use this as a chance to up their prices and blame it on tariffs, even if they weren't actually having an increase in price or whatever, you know what I mean? And it's definitely possible. And I would say probable that some companies will do that. They'll see the opportunity to, you know, raise the prices while trying to not piss people off, you know, too much to have a scapegoat. And that may very well happen, but do not think for a second that every company is going to do that, you know, just to be greedy, because we're not, because we're not doing that. Like I said, I'm not, yes, we're technically paying a little more, but I'm not upping the prices. You know, if I can't afford a couple more dollars per knife, then I'm cutting it way too close in the first place. So, you know,
and now some of that to sort of, I don't know, not that I'm condoning just price gouging for, you know, the sort of fear mongering mentality of, you know, whatever that is.
Right.
But, you know, there are different scales at which knife companies operate. We're not all sort of Fortune 500 companies, but, you know, buying 20 pallets of Magna Cut versus, you know, a pallet or something like that in the cash flow therein could possibly affect, you know, larger companies or, you know, even on the smaller scale, you know, it more about cash flow than possibly, you know, just per price of per part.
Yeah, I guess that can make some difference. But like looking at the Magna Cut, and I don't know, because, you know, like we buy direct from Niagara, the Magna Cut. Yeah. And so, you know, obviously I used to buy, you know, when I was buying smaller quantities, I was buying, you know, bars from New Jersey Steel Baron or Alpha Knife Supply, places like that. And I'm not sure, like, buying it at that level, like what it's doing to the prices. But it basically went up, you know, it's the price per pound that went up. Like, it's not per sheet, or it's per pound. And so you got to assume that that's basically going to be the same across the industry. Now, you know, when you get to a point where you're buying bars of steel versus sheets of steel, you're paying for extra processing because it had to go from a sheet to a bar. You know what I mean? So you're paying for it to be processed down to a size that you can work with if that's what you need to work with. So there's extra cost involved in that. I don't know. I mean, I think that like Niagara kind of has like minimums or whatever. I may be lying. They may not. I mean, you may be able to order like one sheet of Magna Cut from them. I've always needed more than that. So, but
I'm not sure.
Yeah. And in that case, to my knowledge, I'm not getting any kind of a price break for quantity. Now, maybe you get up to some bigger numbers, you know, like maybe some of these big companies
yeah,
maybe Kershaw, they're buying enough that it is.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I'm just, you know, possibly thinking, trying to think through it. Not necessarily, I mean, I'm not raising my prices or anything, but like just trying to, I don't know, maybe give the benefit of the doubt a little bit to some wiggle room, not, you know, egregious wiggle room. I don't know. Just a thought that popped in my head.
Yeah. Well, I would say that if anything, the bigger companies should be, if anybody going to get a price break, it's going to be the companies that are, you know, bigger than us that are buying bigger quantities. So I figure that anybody bigger than us is paying our price or bigger, I mean, or less. And I, like I said, I may be wrong, but I don't think we're getting any kind of price break. Like, I think the price per pound is the same, whether I buy one sheet or whether I buy 20 sheets. So, you know, that being the case, it doesn't technically cost anybody, you know, at whatever size anymore to buy a sheet of steel. Like I said, if you're buying bars versus a sheet, that makes that, but that has always been the case. You know what I mean? Like, you're always paying more for that because of the extra processing. So, I'm not going to say there's not some factors that could factor in, but just know that it's not, you know, at least, and I know the rates have kind of shifted too. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what's going to happen with the tariffs now. If we're kind of locked in, you know, because they came to a deal with the EU. So I don't know, but you know, for a while there, they were changing like almost every week. So, you could potentially buy stuff at a rate one week with a 20% tariff and the next week with a 50% tariff or whatever. But, so obviously that could make a difference, but, if it has leveled off or whatever, and the rate is what it is, then it's, you know, if the rate that we're paying on this batch that we ordered is going to be like kind of ongoing normal, then it's not so much that we have to think about doing a price, you know, increase. And so
that's good. Yeah.
Just putting that out there, partially to ease people's minds, because there's a lot of speculation going on over that stuff. And, you know, and people automatically, one thing that I actually don't like, some of it's deserved because of the actions of some of the people or companies, but not just in our industry, but just in companies in general. But it feels like that people automatically assume the worst about companies, about businesses, like that they're automatically going to be greedy. They're automatically going to screw the customer if they get a chance, like that kind of stuff. Like, so
I think that was my point in trying to bring that up, is they're, you know, just in a microcosm, you know, one scenario may not apply to every business in, you know, perpetuity.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You can't, I mean, it's just like people. There's people that will screw you over in a heartbeat. There's people that are greedy, and there's the same thing applies to companies, you know? So it's, no, don't just assume that because stuff's going on with, you know, tariffs or whatever with the economy in general, that every company out there is going to try to take advantage or going to do the worst case scenario, you know, that because they're not. You know, not everybody. Some, for sure. But that helps, you know, when you see how companies react to stuff like this, that should be a good way to help you decide where to spend your money. Because, you know, if you don't like how a company is, you know, behaving, then don't support them.
But with your wallet.
And vice versa. That's right. So anyway, but yes, I was a little bit scared when he sent me the like, increase, you know, like it was this much per pound, now it's this much per pound. I was like, ah, crap, that sounds pretty expensive. And then I did the math and I was like, well, okay, I can probably live with a couple extra dollars per knife. You know, obviously I would prefer it didn't go up, but because it's not like we run at huge profits anyway. We're not running at the 300% profit, you know, like some of these guys that are just straight up importing finished knives, but that's another discussion. But anyway, so
we're already a good ways into this episode, and we hadn't even got to our topic yet. But
that's all good. Sometimes we just like to ramble.
Sorry, what?
I said sometimes we just like to ramble.
Indeed. Yeah. But on the rambly ramble note, I believe you wanted to share a few knife stories with the good people of the knife.
Yeah, show. Well, I wanted to start doing an ongoing segment and maybe include some of the listeners in on it too, as far as like we need to come up with a cool like little intro for the segment, like knife tales from the wild, or I don't know, something cool. So just like stories about something like a special knife that you lost, or a knife that you lost some funny way, or something crazy you did with a knife. Please do not let us know if you committed crimes with a knife. I do not want to know, and I will not be telling any of them that I think might get me in trouble, because there might or might not be some of those. So we're gonna edit
in private,
huh?
Nothing.
we're gonna be a little careful about what we share here, but what the idea is to kind of for us to share some stories. I know I've got a few that are at least funny or interesting to me, and then I think Chase has got some, and we know you guys have got some. So starting after this episode, you guys feel free to, if it's something that'll fit in the comments, then drop it there. If you want to email it to us at, what's that email again? We'll go ahead and plug that in.
KnifeFreakShow@gmail.com with one S.
There you go. So if we can get some good stories rolling in, then we'll pick some of the best ones and we'll start reading them on air. We'll maybe try to have this at least for a little while, be kind of an ongoing segment. So I think it could be kind of fun. So we'll see. So I'm trying to think where I should start. Let's start with losing knives. And not just now, I've had knives go missing. I have no idea where they went, you know, stuff like that. But I'm talking about cases where, and honestly, most of mine involve water. most of the ones where I've like lost a knife and I know I've lost it is because I lost it in the water somehow. Yeah. So, yeah. So one I remember, okay. So the dumbest one I remember, well, depends on what you call dumbest. I had a knife and I don't even remember exactly what the knife was at this point. Cause I was like, late teens, like high school age, and which has been quite a while ago. But I had this knife that I really liked. I think it was a Lockback, but I wouldn't swear to it. But I really liked this knife. And so it was a folder, of course. And I was fishing by myself in a little John boat out on a pond, that just paddling around in a John boat. And I had the paddle laid on the seat beside me, and I'd tied a new, you know, bait or lure on there or whatever, and use the knife to trim it. And apparently either wasn't paying attention or just made the totally dumb decision. I reached over and set the knife down. Well, when I set it down on the blade of the paddle instead of on the seat of the boat. And so you can probably kind of guess from where it's going from there. So, you know, I pick up the next time I need to shift the boat a little bit, I pick up the paddle and bloop, right over in the water my knife goes. Just dumped it right on in there, and freaked out, you know. It wasn't real deep where I was at. I think it was like, you know, 4 or 5 feet deep. So I actually took my shoes off. I got out and, you know, held on to the boat and like waded around, see if I could feel it like with my bare feet, which in retrospect might not have been the smartest thing since it was an open knife. But, well, I say that. No, it may have been closed. I don't remember if I had closed it or not. But anyway.
I would have done the same thing if it was open. I mean, I sure.
Yeah, yeah, just do. Carefully, yeah, and hope that it didn't get hit and land like point up in some mud or something.
Yeah,
that it might not have been worth finding at that point. So, yeah. So that was one instance where the water got me for sure. Can you remember ever losing one in water anywhere?
I can't remember actually losing one. I almost did one time. It was like right after I got a kayak for my, I think, 8th or 9th birthday or something like that. And I've still got it, still use it. But my uncle's got a little pond out behind his house, and where I grew up, my uncles and my grandmother, my grandparents were basically in the center, and she had 4 sons, and they all just kind of built houses in a square around them. So I sort of grew up on a big farm like that. But, my uncle's house had a big, not a big pond, but a pond out behind it. And that was where I was testing my sea legs with the kayak, not necessarily you know, getting out on the river first. And, you know, after I'd done it a couple times, I was like, okay, I'll take a little fishing rod out there. And I took one of those little collapsible fishing rods out there.
Yep.
And it was either first or second cast. I threw it right into some trees and got it hung up. And I was like, okay, I'll just paddle over and be able to get it. And it, you know, from what it looked like, it didn't look like it was that high. Well, once I got over to it, it was 2-3 feet above where my hands could reach sitting in the kayak. So my thought was, okay, I'll stand up and cut it out of the tree. Well, the standing up went fine. I did that without flipping. The getting back down into the kayak was the part that got me. And I hadn't yet put my knife away for some dumb reason. It was like it was a cheap survival knife that I had gotten from a flea market or something. I don't even know. But it wasn't necessarily the one you always saw. It was a little bit different of a design. Yeah. It was kind of had a little bit of a recurve, bolo-ish sort of tip. Mm. It's an interesting blade profile. But, I used it, cut my line out of the tree, or cut the tree, basically, actually, so I didn't have to cut my line. And getting back down in the kayak, I remember flipping, you know, and I didn't actually lose the knife. I held on to it somehow while I was swimming. My paddle floated away, but I still had the knife. So important things.
Priorities.
Yeah, but I was able to get the paddle back after, you know, getting the kayak flipped over and back on shore and all that. So
a close call, but you did better than I did by retaining it then. Because
I don't know how I held on to it, but things happened.
Yeah. Now, so you could have been really cool, like if you'd just, you know, come up out of the water with it in your teeth and, you know, grab the kayak and launch yourself back up there. That could have been an epic scene.
I did swim across the river once with a knife in my mouth, and I was also carrying nails and 2x4s and a hammer because we were swimming across to nail up a ladder onto a tree that we wanted to jump out of. That was dumb, but.
Oh, me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't know why I had the knife in my mouth. It wasn't really necessary for the operation. I just don't go anywhere without a knife. And so it wasn't necessarily the blade. I had the full sheath and everything in my mouth.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, because it's cool. So.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was a Navy SEAL going across the
river. That's right.
So.
That's right. Well, that actually segues good into my next story, which is, again, in the water, but talking about having the sheath and, like, holding the sheath. I didn't have it in my mouth. I wasn't that cool. But so this was, I don't know, I was, again, late teens, I guess. And I had just gotten in a trade or something, a old timer shark finger. And at the time, I still like those knives a lot, but at the time I really liked the design of the old timer. I don't remember if it was an old timer or a shrade, whatever, sharp finger. And I didn't have a belt on that day. So I couldn't put it on my belt. I was going fishing with my dad and my older brother. And we were going there was a pond down in the woods behind my uncle's house. And so we got down there and we were fishing. I had just taken the knife and like stuck the whole sheath like in my waistband, you know. And so we're sitting there fishing. And so this was like a whole like series of unfortunate events. So we're fishing. And my brother, I don't know what he was doing. Oh, we told him I was in the middle. So my dad was on one end, my brother was on the other end. And like his end of the boat was drifting around. We were like, hey, you know, kick the boat around a little bit. So he went to pick the paddle up and he went to set his rod down. I think the paddle was like on his one side. And then he went to set his rod down on the seat on the other side. But when he did, he missed the seat and like literally just set his rod over the side of the boat right in the water. I mean, it's like he did it on purpose, just literally took it and just set it in the water. He didn't even know he did it because he was like looking over here at the paddle. He did it without looking. And I was like, you just dropped your rod in the water. And he turned around and he was like, what? And then so he freaked out. And so then we're like, okay. So when he was going to rig up another rod with like a treble hook or something on it to try to see if we could drag along and snag it. Yeah. And so he was getting that rigged up and he needed to cut his line. And so he was like, hey, let me see that, I don't know if he didn't have an eye on him or whatever. He knew I'd literally just gotten it. Actually, I'd gotten it from my uncle, like, whose house we went fishing behind. Like, on this trip, I had just gotten the knife. And so I pulled it out. And this one, if I remember right, it did not have a snap on the sheath. Like, it just was like a retention sheath or just a leather slip sheath or whatever. So yeah. I pulled it sheath and all out of my waistband, and I tossed it to him. I was like, here, don't drop that in the water, you know, being a smart ass. And he was like, he was holding it like tipped toward him by the sheath. Yeah. And he was like, oh, I won't. And like joking with me and acting like he was going to throw it in the water. The knife shot out of the sheath, boom, right in the water. The look on his face when that knife hit the water was honestly worth losing the knife, because it was freaking hilarious. I mean, his jaw just dropped. He was just like, oh, he could not. At the time, it sucked, and I was a little pissed, but like, it was so funny that it was worth it. And needless to say, we didn't get the knife back, and we didn't get the rod back. So that pond was a big pond one, us zero that day. So
that's when you just you shut down for the day. You're done. Yeah, nothing's gonna we're go done. Right.
Just, yeah, yeah. So yeah, so I got to own that Schrade sharp finger for a matter of probably 2 hours or less. And it down to the bottom of the pond it went. So yeah, that was one of the funnier ones, I would say, because just I wish that had been in the day of recording everything on our phones and stuff. Because if I could have had that on video, that would have been hilarious.
Yeah.
But yeah. Oh, I won't. right in the drink. Oh man. So
that's rough.
Yeah. Have you ever had anybody that you loaned one to and like broke one or anything, like broke a tip off or anything like that?
Yeah. Another time out on the kayak, I was carrying a Spyderco Delica, and it was me and my wife and her sister and my brother-in-law, her husband. And he asked me for a knife to do something. I didn't ask, which is probably my fault. And he was trying to undo a screw with a Spyderco Delica tip, and they're not necessarily the most robust tips.
Not made for that.
No, not really. But yeah, so that didn't go well. It somehow didn't actually break the full tip off. It just kind of like snapped at the edge and broke off at the edge. So I had to like reprofile it, and it's got this weird like belly right at the tip now.
But, yeah,
you know. It still works. It, you know, it functions.
So. Yeah. I actually broke the tip. It was a Spyderco. I'm pretty sure it was a Delica. It was actually the first Spyderco I ever owned. I bought it on base when I was in the Marine Corps. And at the time was probably the most I'd spent on a knife, if I had to guess. Of course, the PX prices were a little bit better than normal prices, so it was a little cheaper, but anyway, and this was, I knew, like, I didn't even know much about Spyderco knives at the time. Like, this was before I really got into knowing about good knives and stuff, you know what I mean? Like, so,
yeah.
But, and, like, was way more dumb about the intricacies of, you know, using the right knife for the right job and, like, whatever, you know, that they're all, not all made the same. So, anyway. I'm sitting in a Humvee, in the military Humvees. Those of you that haven't been in one or seen one, like this one at least, and a lot of them had the little hump in between the two front, the driver's seat and the passenger seat. It's basically like a hump there, and it just had like plywood bolted down on it. And me being the just dummy that I was or whatever, young, didn't care, I was sitting there for whatever reason. I was always playing with a knife or something. So I was sitting there just like mindlessly, just like stabbing that plywood with my knife like that. Like not real hard, but just like, I don't know. Again, I was a young, dumb Marine. I have no idea why I was even having my knife out. And I did it one time, and obviously I put a little bit of lateral pressure on it or something. As I stabbed it, snapped the tip right off. And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? At the time I thought, you know, I blamed the knife, but, you know, now obviously I realize I was just doing something stupid with it, and that was not made for that fine tip on those is not made for that kind of activity. So, 100% my fault. But yeah, that was my first experience. And that was crazy to think back about all those years ago. That was probably, what year would that have been?
92.
Probably 93. 90. Nah, it would have been, yeah, probably 93, 94, 95, somewhere right in there. Yeah, probably about 94, 95. And then all those years later, I don't remember what year we started the collab with the McBee with Spyderco. It's been several years ago now.
I want to say 2016. Maybe.
That's actually what I was about to say, like 2016. Yeah. So potentially, so that was, if I was right, if I'm right, and it was like 96, what's that?
20 years later.
20 years later, exactly, basically. If, like I said, I'm guessing it when this incident happened in the Marine Corps, but approximately 20 years later, and then I have a collab with them. So that was pretty insane. And this was, you know, back then in 90s, this was far before even really any dreams of being a knife maker or whatever. I was the go-to guy for sharpening people's knives in the platoon and stuff like that. But like the guy that always had the knife on him or multiple knives on him, but like thoughts of actually making knives, like I said, that was before I discovered this whole world wide, beautiful world of knife freaks. Yeah, that was kind of, looking back, it's funny. At the time it pissed me off. I was like, dang, brand new knife. It wasn't cheap and it's already broke. Like, and then obviously just, my stupidity, but gotta own it.
I think that was the Delico was the first Spyderco I owned, and that was like one of the more expensive knives I had bought at the time too. And you know, that was one of the things that like not necessarily taught me about, like, you know, because I already realized, you know, probably shouldn't do stuff with, you know, that tip and stuff like that at that point. But that was one of the things that was like, oh, yeah, maybe I should ask what people are doing before I hand them my knife. And
Yeah, definitely a good, yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So, no, while we're back in the Marine Corps times, I've got, well, I may save one of them for next episode. I probably, one more is probably good for today, but this one's pretty funny. So, there was a guy that was in my platoon that when I first got to my platoon, like right out of my schools and stuff, and went to the platoon I was in. Actually, he wasn't in my same platoon. He was in my company. Got to be friends, and he ended up through me, obviously. Like, my sister was up to visit or whatever, and he met my sister and ended up, they got married. They're living happily ever after now. He's still my brother-in-law. So, all these years later, so got a couple of great kids and all that. So anyway, so he was not my brother-in-law at the time. And I don't remember if he had met my sister yet at this point, like if they were dating or whatever, but, he's kind of, I don't want to say full on like smart ass, but he's not afraid to like, whatever. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think all young Marines may have a little bit of that tendency, but that may
probably
be
a lot of it. So, little bravado, all that good stuff. So, again, as usual, I had a knife out. I have no idea why. No idea. Like, probably wasn't actually using it. I was probably just playing with it. And he was standing there. He came walking up or something, and I was playing or whatever. I was like, I'll cut you. And he was like, okay, go ahead. And like stuck his palm out like that, obviously trying to call my bluff. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I proceeded to reach out and swipe across his palm and cut his hand. He jumped back. Oh shit. You cut me. You actually cut me. You told me to, like, don't tell me to. You're not serious. Oh, so since he's still married to my sister, I'm assuming like he's not going to press charges or anything at this point. So I'm probably good to tell that. But, it wasn't like, I mean, we're talking about like a little, you know, not much more than a paper cut, but still it was funny because he 100% thought he was calling my bluff, and, I called his bluff and he was, his ended up in blood. So yeah. Yeah. Oh, and to my knowledge, I don't remember ever since then, in all the years that we've, you know, hung out and stuff, I don't remember a time where he's ever, gotten me back as far as, like, I don't remember ever bleeding from anything. I don't remember accidentally cutting me or anything like that. So I guess technically he still owes me. Just don't tell him that, because I don't really want to bleed. But it was just the look on his face, because, like, I mean, you could tell he 100% like did not think there was any chance that I would actually do it. Like, and like, was like, yep, now you're bleeding. Shouldn't have dared me. So anyway, all right, well, I've got some more, but we'll save them for another thing. Let's start to get, you guys surely have, again, don't, no, nothing illegal. That's that one I just told was probably about the extent of, pushing the limit on legality that we need to get into. But,
it's not illegal to stab family. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, he didn't press charges or anything. I mean, nobody ever knew. I mean, like I said, it was literally a, you know, not much more than a paper cut, so wasn't a big deal. But anyway, but yeah, guys, share, we'd love it if you'd share some stories with us. Like I said, it can be anything, just any entertaining stories about knives.
Yeah, anytime can you, be, you know, used one in a cool situation, anytime, like, especially stories where, like, knives sort of act as, like, a bonding experience, I think is a cool thing. Like, you know, bringing two people together, whether you gifted or were gifted something, or, you know, something in that manner, and, you know, stuff like that. So,
I think they're not my, not necessarily my favorite, and I'll probably cringe, but if you got one, like, where you've hurt yourself, you know, you dropped one through the top of your foot or something like that, then that's interesting. I just, probably not my favorite ones to hear, but. But we'll take those two.
It happens.
it does. Yep.
I think the only person I've ever cut is myself. And
I've done plenty of that too. So.
Yeah. Another thing we wanted to kind of ask you guys about is we're entertaining the possibility of having some guests on the podcast here in the upcoming future. And we kind of wanted to get you guys' input about, you know, what kind of, who you would like to see on here. Do you want to see, you know, if you want to name specific makers, specific company people, you know, we can reach out or, you know, and just sort of what sort of guests you would like to see on the show.
Yep, absolutely. And like I said, you know, they don't always have to be makers. It can be, you know, we've got couple of ideas of people are in the industry or whatever, but that are, you know, not necessarily makers. So just float the ideas, and we may use it, and we may not be, I mean, may have the connections to get the people, we may not. So, but we can see what we can do.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we between both of us, we've got a fair amount of contacts in the industry, especially him. But you know, half of my contacts are his contacts. So, but I know a few people as well. So, you know, there's the good thing about this community is a lot of us, it's sort of a fairly open door to, you know, go talk to other makers. So just let us know who you'd like to hear from.
Yep.
And we'll try to make it happen.
Yep. I think that will be an interesting thing to do at this point and get some other, and, you know, Chase and I were talking. We do want to get some of their, you know, whoever we bring on, we want to hear some of their story, but we also want to get into some of the topics, maybe even some of the topics that we've already discussed, you know, on here, and get other people's opinions and stuff on them too. And so, you know, not necessarily just a, like, profile of their history or whatever, but a quick rundown of that, and then get into some topics and discuss some stuff. So.
Yeah. Yeah,
what I think we would like to do.
Yeah.
Well, Chase, do we want to? I know we had a few questions kind of backloaded here. Do we want to maybe hit? Do you think we got time to hit that one main one we were talking about before we sign off today?
I don't know which one you're talking about, but
I almost got to see me spit Fanta out. the pricing one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It was a question or a suggestion for an episode from Ian Humphrey, and Ian actually has he's got knives from both of us, and he actually lives up in Huntsville, Alabama, and he's actually been by my shop. Whenever he bought his knife from me, he came down and picked it up from the shop, so he's only about 2 hours north of me here.
Now I'm jealous. He's never come and picked one up from me. I'm just kidding. It's a little farther down here. Yeah, I'm just kidding, Ian. Anyway.
This was a couple weeks ago after we had talked about a little bit of the price of raw materials and stuff like that on that go into it. And he wanted to kind of know, like, how we price our knives, you know, custom versus production sort of pricing, and how much we sort of look at other makers in our similar vein when coming up with a price. Because, I mean, that's a big part of it, too, is sort of price brackets almost of similar type of good. And that was mainly his question, was, you know, sort of seeing what all goes into the pricing other than just, you know, steel, titanium, hardware, that sort of stuff.
What I would call it, like the hard set costs of, you know, of making something.
Yeah.
And then the other factors that go into it. All right, cool. You want to lead it off?
Sure. For me, a lot of it is, you know, that I certainly do kind of keep up with what other custom makers do in my vein. It's sort of harder because it's not as easy to pull up another custom maker on, you know, a dealer website, because not all custom makers use dealers, not all, you know, that sort of stuff. And a lot of the dealers don't even keep, like, custom listings up after they sell. They just kind of turn them off and they're hidden. So it's a little more difficult, but I try to stay on the sort of underside. A little bit of that is ego. Like, I see other makers work and I think it's better than mine, and so I think I should be under it. And some of it is, you know, just I try to provide good value for what I'm making in a lot of ways. And you know, my fixed blade prices have rose since I started, you know, like, but when I was first started making fixed blades, I was offering them, like, my smallest ones were $130 for, you know, fixed blade with a handle and a sheath and, you know, hollow grind and a swedge and all that. And, you know, at the time, I think that was a reasonable price for what I was making, but now I don't think it is. And, I think my quality has improved some, and so I think, you know, the amount of time and effort and that sort of stuff goes into it as well. And then for folders, that's the really hard part, because there's so much diversity in the folder market within different means of manufacturing and different layers of custom and production and all that sort of stuff. So trying to kind of figure out who does exactly like what you do is very difficult to do. Mainly, I sort of just price my folders at what made it worth it for me, where I'm still making money and it's actually worth it for me to deal with the pain that is making them. So
yeah,
any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, that sounds right. I feel like that probably what you described is probably the norm for people as makers, as they start out and then evolve. Most people probably start off a little on the low side and, you know, then their prices go up, which in my mind is probably the better way to do it, because it's always easier to go up on your prices than to go down.
Yep.
So, 100%. You know, as long as you're not running yourself out of business to start with, you know, while you're building up your name, building up your reputation, and building up, most importantly, your skills. Yes. So that's one thing too, that's a factor. That's one of those kind of soft, factors in the knife. Like, you know, in most industries, somebody with more experience and more skills doing something is going to be able to charge more money for whatever they do than somebody that has less experience and less skills. Right. That's common sense, right?
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily about just the end product. I mean, now that being said, the end product needs to reflect those skills. You know what I mean?
Needs to reflect that experience and those, you know.
Yeah. Right. That's right. And you know, there's a lot of variance, because there's some people that, especially now, it seems like there's guys that are coming like out of the gate with, you know, it feels like out of the gate. I mean, you know, they're relatively new, relatively young, and they're doing outstanding work or whatever. Some people develop faster than others. Some people have mentors to work under. Some people don't. Some people have, you know, access to, you know, other people's equipment and stuff. Some people don't. Some people, you know, just have better hand-eye coordination skills and stuff than others don't. Some people are more mechanically inclined than other people are. Yeah. So everybody kind of starts with a different, you know, set of tools in their toolbox or whatever. But anyway, for me and my journey, you know, starting out was very similar to Chase's. Like, that's kind of how, you know, started off. I mean, Lord, I think some of the first knives I sold were like $40, like little Kiradashis and stuff like that. I mean, I was selling stuff for like, you know, $40, $50, $60. So,
well, I mean, I think I ended up at 120 or 130 because you were like, no, you shouldn't charge less than 100 for that, or, you know.
Right.
I think
you had a little guidance
on that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, I've also seen people that where I looked and I'm like right out of the gate or whatever, before they'd even been around a while, like, they're charging prices that seemed equivalent with people that have been doing it for, you know, 10, 15 years. Yeah. And, you know, and back to what I was saying about the thing. So I think whether it's fair and right or not, you know, if you look at, so say you take somebody that hasn't been making very long and somebody that's been making for quite a while, and say their work is actually pretty similar. Say the person that's, you know, newer is doing really good work and it's, you know, it's kind of on par with the person that's been doing it longer. I think there's still something to be said for the reputation and the name that the person that's been doing it longer has built up, especially when it comes into, now, when you come in just straight down to, like, if you're looking at function, stuff like that, it's different. But the most, you know, collecting drives a big part of our industry. So you have somebody that has been in the game quite a while and they've already got an established following and all that. Well, you could argue that their work is worth more from a, like, investment standpoint, because they have a proven track record that they're not going anywhere. You know, they already have a following built up. There's already a secondary demand for their stuff, that kind of thing. So time in the game, I feel like, can be a factor, especially when you start looking at the collecting / investing side of it. You know, even if the end product is similar in quality, I think that time in the game and reputation and stuff and your brand can play a part in that too.
Definitely brand value that's, you know, built up over, you know, years and years and stuff like that.
Right. And you see it everywhere else too. I mean, there are tons of, you know, designer brands out there that are, you know, they're not necessarily better made than some of the brands that are less expensive, but they got that name on them, so they're more expensive. And they're, you know, some of that is just human nature, psyche stuff too. You know, we all play into it of, you know, we won't, not everybody, but most of us are wired to play into that, where we want what's popular. Like, that's just, it's human nature. Like, we can try to deny it all we want, but it is, you know, just kind of the way we're wired, most of us. So that plays a part into it too. For us now, honestly, where we're at with pricing, some of it is just, I mean, obviously we have to look at, like, the bottom line. Are we making enough money off of this to support what we're doing? And, you know, Amy and I got into that really deep on the podcast that she, a couple back, where she was on here with me. So, you know, we're looking at way more than just the cost of raw materials and stuff, because there's so many other factors that go into it. And that's true for everybody to a certain extent, but obviously when you get to a point where you're supporting an infrastructure where you've got, you know, employees and multiple machines and, you know, all the stuff that, you know, paying bookkeepers and accountants and IT people, there's a lot of factors. Like I said, we went, if you haven't listened to that one, go back and listen to that one. And then, some of this
will make more sense. Ian asked this question, I think, before that episode came out, but
yeah, you know. So we probably answered some of it with that kind of roundabout, but yes, we for sure do look at where we are in the market as far as other, I honestly hate calling them competitors, but in reality we are competitors, I guess, but you know, so many of the other companies of, you know, that we are in the price range of, like, or my friends and stuff that, like, feels weird. Yeah. But still, whatever you want to call it, the other companies that are in our, that are our competitors, we do look at that pricing and stuff because, number one, we want to be fair. You know, we want to come in at a fair price, but also I'm at the point now, I'm a little bit different position than Chase is in because, yes, I want to provide good value, but I'm also not trying to, I'm not trying to build a brand on being the cheapest one out there. Like, yeah. I'm trying to build a lug, you know, a brand that's kind of, we, I feel like we kind of walk the line between like luxury type stuff and, but that's still very, you know, utilitarian and usable and stuff. You know what I mean? So like, not yeah. stuff that's like art knives, something that's so fancy that, that blue collar guys aren't out there using them every day and stuff. But that's on the high end of good functional tools. You know what I mean? So yeah. That's where we're, you know, that's where our lane is. And so I'm not interested in getting in a race to the bottom to see who can do it the cheapest because that just ends up with everybody losing. So, you know, we're looking at not necessarily trying to be, you know, the most expensive person in our class, but we're also not necessarily trying to be the cheapest person in our class either, you know? So yeah. it's just kind of a balance of, it, and a lot of it is too, is just what the market will bear. Like it doesn't yes. matter if I think we can, you know, the market ultimately decides, which is what drives me crazy when I see people make comments about stuff. And it's typically, I honestly don't see many comments unless it's a, like I said on another podcast, like every now and then, like a dealer will post a picture or a, you know, a post on one of our knives and you can tell it's somebody that's just not at, they're at the stage of the game where like $100 or $200 knife is an expensive knife to them. And they're not familiar with what yeah. all else is out there. And then they'll, you know, they'll maybe make a comment about how expensive it is. But most of our actual customers, like I really very rarely see anything about price, but you do see it commonly on, like if you go and look in some of the other groups, you know, whatever, like from Spyderco to wherever, you see semi-regularly, you see, you know, people saying that something is, and they don't say, in my opinion, they just say it's overpriced. But it's in their opinion, something is overpriced. Well, if that company is selling thousands of them, I hate to break it to you, but it's not overpriced because that's what people are willing to pay. Yep. So, you know, just because you're not willing to pay it, that's, you know, to you, it may be overpriced, but as a company, you have to look at what the market will bear. You know, I can go out there and say, I'd like to get, you know, I'd love to get $900 for Dixons. And we could probably sell some Dixons at $900 a piece, you know, base model Dixons. We could sell some at $900 a piece, but we would not be able to sell anywhere near the volume that we're selling them at $625 a piece. So yeah. you've got to kind of try to find a sweet spot where you're not leaving a bunch of money on the table. You're not undervaluing your brand. You know, like I'm not trying to build a cheap brand. I'm trying to build a high quality, you know, more on the kind of higher end side of things. And so your prices need to reflect that. So, yeah. you know, now we're not trying to squeak every penny out of it. You know, on that same note, I think we probably could have still sold, you know, close to the same number of Dixons that we sell at $625. If we'd have made the price $700, I think it probably would not have hurt our sales very much at all. And this is just me speculating, but yeah. I felt like that was reaching a little too far and getting a little, you know, kind of starting to hit another price bracket. And I wanted to keep it, you know, where more people could afford it and stuff. So it's, you know, it's all a balancing act. You know, you don't want to devalue yourself. You don't want to get too big for your britches and charge too much. And, you know, it kind of depends on volume too. Like, yeah. you know, how many knives are you putting out? I mean, obviously, like for somebody like Chase, he can only put out so many knives at a time. And like when I was doing it customs, I can only make so many knives at a time. So if it's going to be worth me doing it, you know, and it being my job, well, I have to price them at enough that I can live off of those, the profit off of those prices, right? And if, yeah. you know, again, if the market bears it, it's worth it. If it doesn't, then it's not. And maybe you need to think about either upping your skills or moving on and doing something else, you know? the market will tell you whether your prices are, you know, especially too high. It'll tell you real quick.
That was sort of the, I guess, crossroads I reached with Folders a couple of years ago, or I think it was last year, or maybe 2 years ago. I mean, I was charging like $550, $600 for Folders, and I was just like, this ain't worth it for me. And I just, you know, it wasn't worth my time. It wasn't worth the headache. It wasn't worth the, you know, any of that. And so I upped it to about $800 is around my base price for standard size folder.
And, right,
you know, that makes it worth it for me, gives me the amount of profit I need to have in order for it to be sustainable and for me to keep doing it. Cause otherwise if it wasn't worth it, I wasn't going to do it, you know?
Right. Yeah. You just figure out that you just need to find another, you know, stick with fixed blades or whatever, you know, like that's you know, so yeah, it's and if you're, again, if you're selling them at a reasonable speed or whatever, then you're not overpriced because people are buying them. You know what I mean? So it's, but yeah, you're not going to find many people that are actually making their own stuff that are like super greedy and like just jacking the prices way up just because they can, because you can't, because you can only, I mean, people are going to pay what they're going to pay. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there's certain times, instances where, you know, I've seen it happen, whether it be with like an individual maker or whatever, where somebody, you know, they get a nice wave of hype and stuff built up, and then their prices start to get a little out of hand. And then, usually there ends up being a correction, and those people are either, it's really hard to come back from that. It's really hard to come back and lower your prices, because then that hurts your brand, and, you know, it hurts your, you know, your customers that have bought from you at that price, you know, again, a lot of people are looking at it like as an investment and stuff. So you're basically devaluing their investments. So like I've seen that happen many times where people,
the maker side as well. Cause I mean, if you're in the middle of that hype bubble and you're seeing, you know, your knives sell for twice what you sold it for on secondary or whatever, or, you know, they're going crazy like that. It is, you know, it does feel a little self-deprecating to hold your prices down because of that, you know? So I understand how it happens. It's an easy trap, but I mean, I think it's a rational trap for any person to fall into.
You have to be disciplined. And I've been told a long time ago, and I've seen it prove out multiple times, but like, don't chase the secondary prices. Like you need to set your price at what you're comfortable with. And then no matter what kind of profit other people are making off of, you know, off of your work. Cause the good news is if people are able to flip your stuff and make money off of it, like you're going to be able to sell everything you can make, whether people actually even like your designs or not, because they're going to buy it just because it's an investment and they can make money off of it. If you make it so that other people can make money off of what you're doing, you're guaranteed sales. Actually, Mick Strider told me that a while back. He's like, secondary market is great. Like if you can keep people, you know, wanting your stuff or whatever, like paying higher on the secondary, then it's like, you know, you're guaranteed sales because they know they can buy it and make money off of it. Like they'll buy it just because they know they can make money off of it, not because they actually even like the design or whatever. So it's, you know, but if you try to, and I've seen it happen. I've seen people chase that secondary. They start, like I said, they see they're selling it for like you said, $800, but then they see people, you know, flipping them for $1,600, $2,000, $2,500. And so next thing you know, they've got their price at $2,000. Well, they sell some at $2,000, but then after a while, guess what? They start slowing down and then people aren't buying them. And then, then what do?
Yeah.
You know, like, do you go back to $800? I don't think so. Yeah. You know, so you've really screwed yourself. So, and I'm sure the same thing can happen with companies. That's something I've seen. I think that's a little more on the custom individual side than it is with companies, but I'm sure a company could do the same thing. It's just the secondary tends to be a bigger thing with individual makers than it does with the production stuff, but still there, but it's not as big of a factor. But anyway, so yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we look at, and for sure, you know, other people's pricing is on that. Doesn't mean like if I see somebody else, you know, raise their prices by 10% or whatever, that I'm just going to go automatically chase them and raise my prices by 10%. It's a,
like a gauge, you know, just where do you think you're at in the market, and kind of, you know, set up a top and bottom border and try to try to land somewhere in the middle.
And it's not so much about whatever company or maker or whatever you're looking at. It's not so much about comparing them, is that you're looking at the market. You're looking at what kind of stuff are people willing to pay $500 for, or $600 for, or $700 for, you know? Like, if there's, you know, if you see stuff that's similar to what you're making and you're being honest with yourself and your quality is similar to this product, and people are paying $600 for it all day long from this other maker, well then, you know that you can probably get somewhere in that price range and be okay. You know, there's other factors. Like I said, there's the reputation, the brand, you know, all that stuff that factors into that. Because again, just because, you know, Joe Schmo over here that nobody knows makes a folder that's on par with one over here that's super popular and been around for 30 years doesn't mean that Joe Schmo is going to be able to pull the same prices that popular over here is going to, at least not initially. But it is for sure, you know. So you have to do a lot of self-evaluation of yourself, your product, your brand, and try to decide kind of where you land as far as compared to other people, and then just be reasonable. That's your, basically your market research is, you know, what are similar items selling for? You know, are there other factors there that you've got to account for? Like, you know, in other words, is that brand super popular for whatever reason, this or that reason, that they catch just the right wave, or is it just that they've been around for, you know, 35 years or whatever? So it's a lot to look at, but it's a little bit of everything. It's kind of all of the above, all the hard costs, the soft costs, and then evaluating the market, which
that includes, was sort of a question mark cost, or a fluctuating sort of, you know, deal. Yeah. That one's never really set in stone one way or another. But
So it's complicated, and it's the key thing to remember. So if there's anybody listening that's actually like, that's a knife maker or whatever, my recommendation would be, don't ever like massively undercut yourself, you know, because you can do damage by pricing stuff too low as well. Yes, it hurts your brand. People are going to think, you know, most people, there's always like bargain hunters or whatever, but most people are going to assume that if it costs less, that it costs less for a reason, because it's not as good a quality. So you can for sure shoot yourself in the foot by pricing stuff too low. But I think it's always a safe bet to go a little bit on the low side of what you think is reasonable. And then if you're selling stuff super fast or whatever, then after a period of time, when you think it's reasonable, you can bump your prices up a little bit. That's pretty common. It's normal. People are used to that, but you don't want to way underprice yourself and devalue your brand and devalue your product. And you don't want to come out of the gate overpricing yourself. Yeah, so
for sure. And don't go from 200 to 550 or something like that on a basic fixed blade overnight. That'd be one recommendation I would,
If you're doing that, you were definitely way too underpriced to start with, or you're way overshooting on the price increase. One of the two.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah, that's pretty good discussion.
Yeah. And, we were planning on running a little short today,
and we ran long. Imagine that
be our longest episode so far.
Yeah. Probably should. I should not have suggested squeezing that last question in, but I knew it had been asked a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't want to get gone too long. So
I mean, pricing is one of those things we seem to come back to. This sort of an evergreen topic for us. So, I mean, we seem to discuss it fairly regularly, but thank you for the question, Ian.
Yes, sir.
And, anybody else that has questions or show topic, suggestions and stuff like that, or knife stories, like we mentioned earlier, anything,
send them in.
You know, what
I said, send them in.
Send them in. Yeah. Send them in to knifefreakshow@gmail.com with one S. That is knifefreakshow@gmail.com. Find McNeese Knives on McNeeseKnives.com, McNeese Knives on Facebook, Instagram. I don't know if he's on Twitter, but maybe on Twitter.
Yep, actually are on X. Yep, and okay. These knives on there too.
Sorry, yep. I forget what it's called.
See, I'm up to date, man.
I think you even have a TikTok, don't you?
Yes, but we haven't been active on there in like 3 years, probably. Yeah, I've been trying to get. I'm not taking on another social media. I've been trying to get Amy to fire it back up. So we'll see.
It's that should have been something we talked about last week. Was sort of stretching yourself too thin between different platforms. But
yeah,
we'll get into that some other time.
Yeah. Yep.
Boat Ride Blade Works on Facebook, Instagram, boatridebladeworks.wixsite.com. Still got Knife Freak Show shirts available if you're interested. And we've also got a new logo coming up that I hope to be unveiling soon. So that should be, but yeah. You got anything nice. Else?
Nope. I think we've talked enough. Matter of fact, my voice feels like it's starting to go a little bit. So we appreciate you guys. Thanks for the questions and suggestions. Keep them coming. Have a great week.
And I'll let your freak flag fly.